Bobby Guy. Welcome to the Healthcare Dealmakers Market Update. It's my pleasure to introduce today's topic, Navigating Covenant Compliance in the COVID Era. We appreciate you joining us. This is part of the Healthcare Dealmakers digital experience continuing through the year. As many of our listeners will know, the HDC is a national event we hold each year in May in Dallas. This is the 13th annual this year, and lucky 13 means that if there was ever a year for disruption for the conference, this was it. So we've had a great time adapting the HDC into a virtual experience that continues throughout the year. This is probably the 7th or 8th event, in addition to the 2-day virtual conference that we did in May. For today, on the sticky topic of covenant compliance in the non-compliant COVID world, we've got a group to talk us through the issues for the next half hour. In addition to today, in November, we'll have a half-hour market update on the pharmacy space. And then on December 1, we've got a market update on trends in the behavioral sector. The 10-Minute Health BizCast is putting out more episodes each month, and we would love suggestions for guests you'd like to hear from. And in case of interest, yesterday, Carissa Jones of Mercodia and I published an article called Getting Our Lives and Economy Back, 4 Steps to Beating the Pandemic. It's available on LinkedIn and the Health BizCast website. Now I'd like to introduce my colleague, Jessica Zeiger, today, who's going to lead the discussion for our market update. This is an easy introduction. Jessica is one of the most talented, bright, and fun finance lawyers I've ever gotten to work with. Those three qualities are rare. The audience is probably chuckling because you can also put them together with finance lawyer and think they're even more rare. So Jessica will be a pleasure talking us through these today. She, the experience side, she ran the biggest nonprofit bond deal in healthcare in the country last year, maybe ever. And I'll hand the reins to her now to introduce the panel.
Thanks, Bobby. As Bobby mentioned, I practice almost exclusively in the area of healthcare finance, and I am probably abnormally excited today to talk with you all about covenant compliance and to introduce my amazing panelists. Today, we have Robin Fisher. Robin's a vice president and a research analyst in Franklin Templeton's Municipal Bond Department. As part of their healthcare analytical team, Robin performs primary market analysis and surveillance of hospital bonds. Our other panelist today is Matt Robbins. Matt started his career in the nonprofit healthcare finance group at Citigroup, and he's now a senior vice president with Kauffman Hall and a leader in that firm's mergers and acquisitions and treasury and capital markets practices. Having participated in more than $15 billion in total borrowings, Matt works with national health systems, academic medical centers, district hospitals, medical groups, hospice providers, and health plans, advising them on debt restructuring, different types of financing, bondholder and creditor negotiations, and other capital markets activities, as well as on their M&A and joint venture activity. So as we talk about covenant compliance today, Robin is going to graciously give us her bondholder perspective, and Matt's going to help give us the perspective of those advising the borrowers on these types of debt. So as we all know, earlier this year, COVID hit healthcare providers in a very unique fashion, especially for hospitals and larger health systems. The elimination of elective procedures and the incredible increase in expenses to manage COVID patients resulted in cash flow troubles for so many healthcare providers around the country. And in the senior living space, having residents fear for COVID outbreaks and fewer people moving into such facilities. Similarly, those healthcare providers experienced increased expenses and significantly reduced revenues. So from a finance lawyer, finance advisor, and bondholder perspective, we all started doing our jobs and taking a look at what the debt documents these providers had in place said about financial covenant performance and started talking with people throughout the industry about what we should do with these sorts of covenant defaults. Any conversation about covenant defaults has to start by focusing on what type we're talking about, because different types of covenants, of course, have different types of consequences. When we're talking about financial and operating covenants, we have a lot of options. But when we're talking about payment defaults, our options are significantly limited. Initially, at the start of COVID, we were a little concerned that debtors might choose not to make payments to preserve liquidity. We haven't seen a lot of that. Hopefully, it doesn't start arising. But I'll ask Matt to weigh in on our first question and tell us a little bit about the types of covenants that borrowers are most focused on when they're thinking through this COVID environment and in this market.
Yeah, and thank you for that introduction, Jessica. And to your question, they're the most focused and nervous about kind of earnings-related tests, so typically debt service coverage covenants. As we think back to earlier this year, when COVID first was hitting the country back in the March and April timeframe, this was very much a liquidity crisis for our healthcare clients, and there was a dash for cash as people were trying to make sure they had the balance sheet resources to move through the crisis. A lot of that has been abated either through bank lending or the different stimulus acts and Medicare advanced payments that have come through, as well as management actions around expenses, reductions in force, et cetera. And so now we're into the part of the crisis where it's more of a credit crisis, and you're trying to think about your earnings. You know, how can you operate at, you know, lower volumes than you had before? A lot of the lower acuity work is staying home or migrating to a virtual environment. And there's uncertainty about how this stimulus money can be applied. You know, is it lost revenue? Is it reimbursement for expenses? A number of big organizations like Cleveland Clinic and HCA have actually paid back their stimulus, so they don't have any of those concerns. Obviously, not every borrower is able to do that. So, you know, liquidity covenants are down the road in terms of depending on how long this crisis might go. But right now, it's debt service coverage and the ability to generate enough EBITDA in the current period.
Thank you. Yeah, I think that's a really important thing, you know, to make sure all of our listeners are focused on, because in the healthcare space, so many of our covenants are annual covenants, right, based on annual earnings over annual debt service. So a unique year like this, you could easily trip a covenant, even though over, you know, the past 5 or 10 year period, you might be looking very healthy. Robin, how does the type of covenant default that a borrower is looking at or potential covenant default impact your responsiveness from bondholders and you know, bondholder involvement in developing a plan of working through that default?
Right. Thanks, Jessica. So I will say, outside of a payment default, which obviously gets immediate attention by your creditors, Jessica and Matt both talked about what bondholders call technical defaults, which are the financial covenant breaches that they both mentioned. And generally what we see is either a rate covenant violation or a day's cash on hand, like Matt said, with the advanced payments. Most providers, at least those who are above sub-investment grade ratings, tend to think that their liquidity is just fine as of now. But we have seen some people be concerned about the rate covenant, depending upon how they can retain or bring through the CARES Act grants going forward. So from, I think, more important than the type of technical default, I would say it's more important to focus on how the issuer is actively communicating with creditors. What we'd like to see is, we don't want to be surprised. Did we know that a default was possible? Was it imminent? Is management being proactive, forthcoming, and transparent? You know, institutional investors like to think of themselves as long-term credit capital partners with the issuers. You're often doing 30-year paper with us, and our ultimate goal is to be paid in a timely fashion. So as far as generating a plan to work through technical defaults, generally speaking, a trustee will retain counsel on behalf of the holders, and response times can be relatively quick. But if, depending upon how widely an issuer's debt is held, organizing a bondholder group of critical mass can take some time.
Yeah, that makes sense. I think that's consistent with what we're seeing around the market. So one thing that we've been hearing a lot about is what do we do if we have a default? And the answer to that, of course, varies dramatically depending on the credit and the type of debt that a borrower is party to. One thing people talked a lot about at the beginning of the crisis was whether COVID and the related, you know, covenants were going to force some people to enter into this active healthcare M&A market or, you know, refinance their debt, which are, of course, two of the more draconian options, you know, that you'd be facing in light of a covenant default. Matt, are you seeing significant refinancing or M&A activity driven by COVID, either with respect to events of default or just generally?
No, I really would say we haven't, Jessica. I think the refinancing activity that's out there is largely driven by just, you know, kind of investment grade rates being so attractive, but not the type of covenant-driven refinancings that you might have seen in the past. You know, M&A is another place where, you know, that activity, I think, has maintained its cadence that it's had in years past. You know, organizations that were struggling going into this have really been knocked sideways, and so strategic options become a real major concern. You know, larger health systems are, a lot of them are looking at, you know, their portfolio a lot harder and trying to think about which markets and also which business lines they really want to be in, and also how, you know, virtual visits and other things start to come in. Now, there has been a huge benefit to systemness in this crisis, the ability to move resources around. So although we haven't seen any, you know, specific M&A deals that you could drive out of the COVID crisis, you know, the ability to be larger and able to flex resources has been a huge positive.
Thank you. Yeah. So, if you're not going to take the draconian route, of course, your less dramatic option is to start negotiating grace periods, covenant modifications, and waivers. And what we've seen a fair number of hospitals or health systems try to do is take a look at their coverage ratios, not so much liquidity, because I don't think we're seeing a lot of people with potential liquidity defaults, but especially with annual coverage ratio tests, going out to their creditors now and saying, you know, we're thinking we might have this event of default. Will you just agree to waive it? Because obviously this is a unique situation. Do we have to modify the covenant to a lower threshold? So negotiating around these covenants can take a lot of forms, right? The advance waivers, waiving the existing default amendments, and even as far as forbearance agreements. So, Robin, can you give us your perspective? How willing are bondholders to give an advance waiver, like what I talked about, you know, for a hospital or a health system that thinks there's a decent chance they're going to have the default, but they're not 100% sure?
Right. So far in the pandemic, I, at my firm, have personally been asked for one prospective waiver. I will say that all the institutional holders involved in that deal were pretty much like, no. You know, institutional holders don't like to give advanced waivers. And it's hard, like back to my point about organizing critical mass and 51% of your holders. You're often having to get 12, 13 different players and investors on the same page. And that doesn't happen often. And, you know, the exchange that they want for a waiver or a forbearance agreement can be varying, like widely disparity in terms of what people are willing to give in exchange for what. So I would say if there is an anticipated default, we'd be more inclined to discuss a forbearance agreement for a period of time and often tied to bondholders receiving something in exchange. These types of things could include increased security, enhanced disclosure practices, retentions of consultants, maybe even a uptick in a coupon payment if in the event that you don't hit your target. But unlike banks, we can't offer different products or services. We can't take what we often refer to as extortion payments, as some of your insurers, a bond insurer could take. So our leverage is the ability to accelerate the debt in exchange for some kind of enhancement to the security package. So I would say that prospective waivers, unlikely, willingness to work in exchange for a benefit to the holders of, you know, the paper, then I think that there's definitely a willingness to come to the table.
That's so interesting. And it's most interesting because Matt and I negotiate that from the other side on an almost daily basis. Because, right, this conversation goes very differently with other types of creditors. So when you're looking at a debt portfolio for a healthcare provider that's got a lot of bank debt, in it. That's a much easier situation in which to negotiate an advance waiver. Matt, do you want to talk a little bit about how your strategy varies when you're talking about negotiating bank covenants, which oftentimes are tighter than bondholder covenants to begin with?
Yeah, there's a number of aspects to that. I think, you know, Robin hit on a bunch of the points about kind of the different kind of incentives at play. You know, bank debt does tend to have, you know, slightly enhanced covenants to what the master indenture might have. You know, they're private loans typically, so there's a different level of information that can be shared than if you're doing a public process with bondholders like Robin would look at. And I think the other key aspect is, you know, not that the banks want to lose money, but there's other ways, there's other channels that they push product in, and lending is just one of them. And so there are kind of other forces at play as you think about that. You know, I mean, you and I did work, Jessica, on one earlier this year where, thinking about that as an example, it's really interesting to think about the uncertainty in the forecasts of that, where when we first started modeling performance for that organization, you know, we felt like a default was certain this fiscal year. And then every update since, the picture has gotten better.
Right.
As volumes have come back, the expense management initiatives come into play, this Medicare advance payment money keeps getting delayed, and it now is on a much longer fuse. So the situation that in April and May looked extremely dire from a performance view now just looks kind of bad when you bake in all those things. And so that's a different conversation you can have with private lenders and rating agencies that I think, you know, Robin, thinking about it from your perspective, you could have with a group of public bondholders where that information is going to be broadcast everywhere.
Right.
I agree with that. I was just going to add, like, you know, and more importantly than even just what is the projection or here's the rate covenant I think I can hit. And I understand, I know Jessica will chime in, that there are securities laws. And the last thing an institutional holder wants is material non-public information. So whatever you can share in how budgets were formulated or what are the contingency plans and how is the boardroom thinking about it and what's the pivot in the event that a second wave hits or, you know, the stock market crashes and the election's in turmoil. Those are the kinds of things that really help investors get comfortable, more importantly than a number of what you think you're going to hit in terms of a future rate covenant.
And the strategy here, for most borrowers, well, of course, it's unique for everyone, depending on what their capital stack looks like. Some borrowers are focused on this now as a potential default, where they have some measure of control over eliminating that potential default. And I say it that way because if you're a hospital or a health system that has, you know, only a hard default on your bank debt, well, you can actually, you know, practically speaking, go out and eliminate that risk by negotiating it with your banks, you know, using ancillary business, you know, future business considerations and, you know, frankly, just information sharing and saying, you know, we don't want to deal with this event of default. But for those healthcare borrowers that have a potential default and widespread public bonds, that's not a reality, right? In most cases where they're not going, either the default's going to happen and we'll deal with it when it does, or it's not going to happen and we don't have to worry about it. Given the complexity of dealing, you know, with multiple public bondholders, it probably isn't worth their resources to start those negotiations even before, you know, the end of your fiscal year. Do you guys agree with that strategy?
I would.
Yeah, we would as well, Jessica, that, you know, I think as Robin mentioned, I mean, you know, in these situations, proactive communication is important to kind of maintaining credibility and, you know, access to capital in the future should you need it. So the sooner you can get out there, I think be as kind of honest and forthright as you can. I mean, even the conversations we're having with rating agencies where you're kind of telling them everything. You know, there's a high degree of uncertainty about forecasts, and so a lot of the conversations are consistent with what Robin mentioned around how are you scenario planning? What type of contingency plans do you have in place? Are you, you know, are you doing an actual budget? I mean, who can think 3 to 5 years in the future right now, but even just 1 year out, how are you setting targets and goals for performance, and how are you measuring and holding yourself accountable? That type of rigor and, you know, organizational focus is really important in these moments.
Yeah, and we've teased it a couple times now, but you know, the other really hot topic for healthcare borrowers throughout this COVID experience has been disclosure and information sharing issues. For healthcare borrowers that only have private debt, this is really a non-issue, right? It's a business decision. Your banks or creditors are going to want to know how you're performing and what you're projecting, and you can speak as freely with them, you know, as you're comfortable with from a business perspective. But for those borrowers that have publicly offered debt, there are some meaningful securities law disclosure questions that you have to consider when you're sharing that information with, you know, as both Matt and Robin have mentioned, you've got different considerations whether you're sharing it with a bank, a public bondholder, or a rating agency, which falls somewhere in between those two, although they would probably disagree with me on that front. So it has been very interesting to see the different levels of disclosure that borrowers have put out into public offering documents if they're actively in the market, into their continuing disclosure filings, you know, as they're reporting annually or quarterly, or, you know, information that they're sharing in direct response, you know, to information requests from their creditors. And while it's easy, you know, to advise borrowers that they can disclose, you know, their actual performance and experience during COVID, you know, since COVID hit, as far as expenses and revenues and the like, it is a much trickier question when you're asking for budget information or projected financial information. Whereas if you had asked me, and certainly me, maybe Matt, about a year ago, we would have said that you don't make any sort of disclosures about your budget or your projections, at least in the hospital and healthcare space, sometimes budgets in the senior living space, but certainly no projected financials. And at least in my experience, that has changed dramatically, where lots of healthcare providers are disclosing, you know, round numbers for how far off they expect to be on EBITDA or coverage ratios. Matt, I'll start with you. What are you seeing? How are you advising borrowers to respond to those kinds of requests for information?
Yeah, I think a lot of care goes into what is put out in the public sphere. And in the spring, in addition to the kind of disclosure that goes into those kind of more marketing type documents, Jessica, as you mentioned, people in, you know, in the primary market, you know, there were quite a lot of just kind of voluntary EMMA filings around what's happening. And, you know, some of those just kind of restated what you could have gotten from the New York Times. Some of those into a great amount of detail into what specifically was going on in that organization's market and how they were responding. I'd say the velocity of those has diminished quite a bit, and folks are more focused on what goes in maybe the kind of their quarterly and annual disclosure filings. And I think there's still reticence to put a whole lot in there around kind of future targets, knowing that, you know, competitors and others might have access to that information. But, you know, I think there's a understanding that we have to give some type of guidance about how we're weathering the crisis. And the type of things that we're doing. So it's still a balancing act. And I think, you know, some of the things that you read a year ago would have been absolutely not, I think, are getting more of it's a balancing, you know, decision about what can we say to kind of keep the communication lines open versus, you know, what gives away too much that we wouldn't want to share publicly.
Yeah. Robin, what would you tell borrowers about how to walk that tightrope, right? You are intimately familiar with, you know, what is too much information to share and what information you'd rather not have. What do you think about when you're crafting those kinds of requests, understanding these limitations, and what are you expecting to get back so that you can really evaluate, you know, these types of defaults and the financial performance of your credit?
Right. Well, and I think that you and Matt can both appreciate the disparity between a best in practice disclosure packet and just getting a P&L and balance sheet and maybe volume. It runs a gamut of how sophisticated, how intense, how robust the quarterly and annual disclosure packets are for issuers to begin with. And some have really stepped up in this COVID environment, and it's been very helpful, and it's probably really alleviated the demand on the C-suite time in terms of responding to bondholders' comments. When you see low water mark volume, where they are today in terms of a percentage of pre-COVID budget, and being able to give some forward guidance to the market at the same time in a public fashion is very, very helpful for us understanding where the organization is going. And like Matt indicated, the systems that had gone into the pandemic on strong footing with good disclosure practices, those are the ones we're really seeing stepping up and even being better at disclosure. The ones that were flailing coming in, those are the ones that we continue to get more pushback on, more sparse disclosure, and you're seeing a lot of holes, which just raises a lot of questions, and then which in turn means a lot of phone calls going into the C-suite. So I would just encourage and implore everybody to put as much information in the public domain as you can and that you're comfortable with. And to Matt's point, what I talked about earlier is more important even than what you think you're going to do. Like, what were the inputs? What were the considerations? What's the contingency plan? And how are you going to get there? And if it doesn't happen, you know what? We have these levers in our back pocket that we can pull to really, you know, to close the gap.
That's super helpful as far as, you know, giving guidance to people thinking through these issues. As we're nearing the end of our time, I, of course, want to thank Matt and Robin. Matt, anything else you want to add to the discussion before we wrap up this incredibly quick tour through handling covenant compliance?
Yeah, the only thing I'd add, Jessica, and you'd hit on it, is, you know, the kind of the devil's in the details here. You know, some of these kind of debt service coverage tests have, you know, language that carves out extraordinary items, force majeure, multiple periods, you know, they have kind of 2 years of a failure before it's an event of default. And so those details obviously matter, and understanding kind of what you have and who it's with is a really, really important first step in this exercise to make sure you're approaching these conversations kind of appropriately.
Oh, that's so true, and especially for the large number of healthcare borrowers out there that have what we call a MADS coverage, right, a maximum annual debt service coverage. I know Robin is cringing. If we were on the video, you would see it, but you could, you know, we've even heard some people say that they could start manipulating their MADS coverage by paying down, you know, large bullets out there and the like. So that's absolutely true. Robin, did you have anything you wanted to add before we wrap it up today?
No, I would just say that, you know, we're not the enemy. We're not a rating agency. We don't hold you and downgrade you based upon not meeting your projections. So we would implore transparency and best practices and disclosures. And, you know, we're here to be your capital partner for the long term.
Thank you so much to both of you. With that, I will turn it back to Bobby, who I know has a couple of announcements to make for all of you participants in our ongoing series. Thank you.
Jessica, thanks very much. Thanks today to all of the team and for the discussion around this. I think it's going to be interesting how all of this goes if we don't see more stimulus packages here coming soon. And I think very, very timely and greatly appreciated. Thanks to all of our sponsors for the HDC. Thanks also to all of our audience and friends for joining us today. We look forward to having you join us in November and December for the pharmacy and behavioral market updates, and we would look forward to your thoughts on future guest episodes on the Health BizCast. Thanks very much, everyone. We are concluded for today.